Okie dokie. Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 13, 2006, from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We have a wonderful show for you today with one of our favorite guests, Norman Solomon, the distinguished columnist and author and probably one of the smartest media critics in the nation, if not the smartest, will be joining us live for a full hour to answer your questions and my questions and give his analysis of media coverage of the raging events in the world and the nation today. So join us today for Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Congress has adjourned for a month-long recess, but that is not stopping the drive to pass some form of telecom legislation this year. The Senate Commerce Committee, chaired by the now infamous Alaska Republican Ted Stevens, is circulating a glossy promotional brochure touting the senator's version of telecom reform, which does not include any provision for protecting network neutrality online. The brochure is accompanied by a handout of selected newspaper editorials against network neutrality. Though the bulk of newspaper comment has been in favor of internet freedom, no mention is made of that reality. In order to counter this bizarre marketing push, Google's chief evangelist, Vint Cerf, the man who designed the network protocols on which the internet runs, has half-jokingly considered the production of a comic book to carefully explain just how the internet works to lawmakers. Cerf believes the lack of high-tech understanding on Capitol Hill makes the lobbying job of phone and cable companies easier since they can stretch technical truths without being called out for it. Once the Stevens brochure's existence became public and started to attract criticism, it was pulled from the Senate Commerce Committee's website, though copies exist elsewhere online. As Congress folks circulate throughout their home states and districts, they're getting an earful about the need to preserve network neutrality. Ted Stevens fought like mad to try and cobble together a coalition of 60 senators in order to preempt debate on the subject before the August recess, and he failed. Now, some senators up for re-election this year say net neutrality is such a contentious issue that they'd rather not vote on it before the November polls. For people like Robin Miller of Bradenton, Florida, who videotaped a backyard chat on the subject that he's now sharing online, it may be the defining issue.
So here's the question. Are you going to support politicians? And that, by the way, is most of the people in Congress who voted against net neutrality, which means they voted in favor of big companies dominating the internet the same way they now dominate cable TV and the airwaves. Or are you going to vote in favor of Congress people who support net neutrality, which is certainly necessary to keep new entrepreneurial, creative people coming onto the internet and blessing us with new and better work? It's your choice.
Dozens of videos like this have been created in the last several months. Visit SaveTheInternet.com for a sampling. The problem is, what few legal and regulatory provisions that still exist to protect network neutrality online expire next year. These were temporary conditions placed on the mergers of AT&T with SBC and Verizon with MCI by the Federal Communications Commission. In preparation for this change, at least one computer scientist is designing code to analyze network traffic and identify if telecom companies do begin to discriminate. Once the program, which uses a technique called active probing, is completed, its developer plans to make it freely available.
Next year's funding for public broadcasting remains in flux. Earlier this year, a House committee approved a bill to effectively defund the Corporation for Public Broadcasting by the end of the decade. Now a Senate committee has approved an appropriations measure that would restore some of public broadcasting's government funding for next year, especially to fund certain children's programming initiatives, as well as ongoing transition of television stations from analog to digital broadcasts. In related news, TV producer Warren Bell has been nominated to fill a slot on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's board of directors, vacated by Kenneth Tomlinson, who was run out of the CPB chairmanship last year after ham-handed attempts to inject conservative bias into PBS and NPR programming. Bell is also a self-professed conservative, though he's already promised that if confirmed to a board position, he'll execute his duties in a nonpartisan fashion.
And now, here's a Media Minute's Fast Fact. The Future of Music Coalition just released an in-depth study about the effects of consolidation on the radio industry. From 1996 to 2003, the top four radio companies managed a double-digit percentage increase in market share across the country. And in those markets that experienced the most consolidation, radio journalists and producers suffered the most job losses. Those who survived the cutbacks found their wage growth slowed. Less local people on the air means less local content on the air. Clear Channel is leading a new push to allow greater radio consolidation as part of the FCC's new media ownership rules review. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 13th, 2006, from Campbell Hall in beautiful and historic Urbana, Illinois. Today we have one of our regular guests on Media Matters, on at least once a year, if we can get him here. And we're very fortunate to have him today. Norman Solomon is a syndicated columnist in media and politics. His weekly column, Media Beat, has been in national syndication for the last 14 years. And he is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a national consortium of policy researchers and analysts. And I should add, for editorial forwardness, that I am on the board of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a position I'm proud to hold. It's a pleasure to welcome Norman Solomon to the air, and I should also add that Norman Solomon is the author of the new book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, which was published in the summer of 2005. Norman Solomon, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, Bob. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Yeah, it is. And boy, there's a lot to talk about. You know, one of the things I would urge our listeners to do if they aren't doing it already is to make sure they read Norman Solomon's columns, which are what, twice a week you write, Norman?
More or less.
And I go to normansolomon.com on the web, where you can find everything archived, or Common Dreams carries it, or if you're lucky, your local newspaper will carry it, or Alternate carries it. At any rate, it's must reading, because invariably you take the current breaking issues and discuss the media coverage of them. And what I like about your columns, Norman, is you bring a lot of fresh information in. It's not just your opinion, but you've got invariably in every column something I didn't know before I read it, which is very instructive for me as I try to make sense of this world.
Well, trying to make sense of it, what a task. And I often think, with only a little bit of hyperbole, that the role of the mass media in general in our country is to make it exceedingly difficult to make sense of the world. It's almost like, you know, those 500-piece puzzles that we might have dumped on the living room table, but some of the pieces are just plain missing, and so it's hard to make sense of the picture.
It is indeed, and let's try to make some sense of the picture, and let's talk about the media coverage of some big issues that are taking place in the world in the United States today. Just in the last week, we had Joseph Lieberman lose in the Democratic primary to Ned Lamont. Almost unprecedented for a three-term senator who, you know, won by landslides in his last two re-elections, vice presidential candidate of his party in 2000, to be ousted by the voters in a primary in his own state. What was your take on that? Is that very important politically or historically? And what did you make of the press coverage of that, Norman Solomon?
Well, I think it is real significant, as you mentioned, that it's very unusual for a sitting congressperson to be denied the seat, most of all in the primary of his or her own party. And I think that if we had held a vote among, let's say, the certified media pundits who live within or around the Beltway, Lieberman would have gotten, rather than 48%, probably about 98%, which is part of the reason why I think it was a surprise to reporters. I think many people who were not within that sort of incubation of ideas or what passes for ideas would have realized that out in the grassroots, there's just so much anger and frustration at accommodation towards the Bush administration, perhaps most of all in terms of the war in Iraq. And yet, you know, the pundits loved Joe Lieberman on the whole, with a few exceptions, because he fit the right prescription, a so-called centrist or a moderate Democrat. And so I think it was kind of a clash of worlds and a lot of anger and certainly some negative comments from a lot of journalists and outright pundits after election night. You know, this is a step backward for the Democratic Party. It's really the same drum that's been banged on for at least 20 years, where the savants who cover for the major media the political scene of the country keep advising the Democrats to not stray far from the center, whatever the heck that is.
Our guest today, Norman Solomon. You're listening to Media Matters. If you want to call in, the number 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Norman Solomon, of course, is a syndicated columnist who is Media Beat column, and he's also the author of Where War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, published just about 1 year ago exactly, but still as important a book as ever, I say with a certain amount of regret. Norman, let's talk about the Lieberman race. A big deal was made out about how the Democratic Party is being taken over, sort of a purge of sorts, a coup in the Democratic Party by the loony left, by these net roots activists. This is a not uncommon framing by the news media. What's the story behind that?
Well, I don't know. Unless I was hallucinating when I studied civics in school, one of the main things about election campaigns is supposed to be debating issues. And then the voters, you know, not the savants or the particularly corporate high-profile journalists, get to decide what proper policy is. And so in the case of Lieberman, here's somebody who I think was more or less in the center of gravity of the news media, which was, you know, the war in Iraq is unfortunate, but it's necessary. We have to tough it out. It would be a disaster to leave prematurely, whatever that means. And the grassroots of the Democratic Party voted very differently, at least a bit more than a majority. And that was seen as a catastrophe. So it's almost like turning the pyramid of governance that we were taught on its head or on its pinnacle, and that, you know, it kind of reminds me in a different context, yet some resonance, of Bertolt Brecht.
I was thinking the exact same thing when you were saying that. Go ahead.
Yeah. When there were some uprisings in East Germany, communist East Germany, and Brecht's comment was that when he looked at the crackdown from the East German government, that if the government didn't like the people, it should elect some new ones.
Our guest, Norman Solomon, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. There's Norman Solomon, arguably the best media critic in the country today, and we've got a lot to cover because there's so much going on in the world. And please do call in, and we've got plenty of lines open for people who want to talk with Norman Solomon today on Media Matters. Of course, the huge stories, one of the many stories going on is the war on terror, and now the arrests that were made for the prospective blowing up of airliners over the Atlantic Ocean. We're now in the fifth year of the official war on terror, and I guess that's considered World War IV or V. I get lost, but I guess it's going to be here forever. And, you know, you've been watching the war on terror. You've been watching the press coverage of it. How would you regard the press coverage in the last week, and where does it fit into a pattern? Is there a pattern over the last 2 years you've seen over how the press, the mainstream press, cover the U.S.'s war on terror?
Well, I think if there's a way in which the news media have been more or less, with notable exceptions, been sort of locked into a certain, you know, compound of thought, then when they wander and some big event happens that is ballyhooed as a crossroads in what's called the war on terror, there's kind of a recidivist response where they scurry back to that accustomed ground, you know, within the walls of thought, and that is that there's a war on terror in the world. It is more or less, with some tactical lapses, what the White House says it is, and it's a good versus evil. And I think it's a dual discourse, really, that's true both in terms of U.S. policy in the world and, as we've seen in the last several weeks, Israel's policy in the Middle East, that on the one hand, there's the storyline of morality, that we always hold the very, very high ground in that regard. And then meanwhile, there's the reality of the power imbalances, where the United States has so much military might, as has been exerted in Iraq now for more than 3 years, and it's the U.S. government's capacity demonstrated on an almost daily basis to take many lives with this enormous geopolitical leverage and high technology and so forth. It's almost that the two trains are running, and rarely shall they meet in news media. So the sum effect of the dual discourse is that while we are looking out at it and are accustomed to it, for most of the world, and this is demonstrable by the Pew charitable trust polls that they've commissioned through their people in the press polling apparatus around the world, almost every country in the world, the vast majority of people think that the United States is the biggest threat to peace in the world, think that the United States, rather than waging a war on terrorism, is terrorizing people with the Pentagon's military might. And so there's a massive disconnect, and the U.S. media tend to just keep covering the same ground, and the most wide-ranging departure from that usual ground is that tactically this might be a bad thing to do. You know, I heard the what I think very cogent comments of Russ Feingold a few hours ago with George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week program, and you know, Feingold was making, I think, a very good case that the war in Iraq is counterproductive in terms of what is defined as the war on terrorism. But that said, you know, it's kind of like the only acceptable argument against U.S. policy is that it's bad for the U.S. And it's as though those on the other end of the missiles and the bombs produced in the USA have only walk-on parts and are significant primarily because of what it might do to U.S. geopolitical positioning around the world.
Our guest today, Norman Solomon. You're listening to Media Matters. This is WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. We're coming to you live today, August 13th, 2006. So callers are welcome. The phone number 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. Norman Solomon is the author of the weekly column Media Beat and also the new book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Norman Solomon also is the executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a national consortium of policy researchers and analysts. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, beautiful Farina, Illinois. You're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hi, thank you very much. There was a couple of programs on PBS Frontline. One not so long ago called The Dark Side, about Cheney's manipulation of the truth in the buildup for Iraq, and another one about a year and a half ago called Rumsfeld's War, that detailed Rumsfeld's career. It was pretty blatant that, I mean, the lies and the manipulation of the truth. I want your comment on those in the PBS format, but also I want your comment on the complete ignoring of a potential impeachment. And I think impeachment is a real possibility if the media could expose it, and I think a lot of people would really get behind it. Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Norman, if I can sort of add on to that or help shape that question, because it raises some very good points. Do you think the Bush administration, the current Bush administration, is significantly different from previous American administrations in terms of its relationship to the truth and foreign policy? And then secondly, do you think, answer the impeachment question?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a matter of degree, and we certainly had every administration that I've studied of the last 50 years fundamentally engage in deception in terms of U.S. policy in general, and perhaps in particular in terms of taking the country to war. That said, sometimes the quantitative changes in terms of the extent of lies and deception become qualitative as well. And so I think that this George W. Bush administration has been the most mendacious, the most committed to an ongoing policy of deception. And when you consider how we got into or dragged into the Vietnam War and so forth, for instance, I can't say it's high praise. It's high something to high jump over these very, very towering achievements of deception of previous administrations. And yet, in terms of impeachment, I think that as the Constitution has really no clear definition other than what, high crimes and misdemeanors, it's always been a political process, as we saw, you know, right after the Civil War, as we saw with Bill Clinton and with Nixon, I suppose, although the substance was clearly there in that case. And so when people say, well, gee, President George W. Bush deserves impeachment, I think a very strong case has been made already to that effect. But for that matter, if you look at the last several decades, most of our presidents have engaged in what I think we could call impeachable defense offenses in terms of deceiving the Congress, deceiving the public, breaking the law in terms of surveillance and abridgment of civil liberties, and it's always a matter of who has the political leverage to pull it off. And I don't think there's any indication on Capitol Hill that such leverage really exists.
How do you think the press coverage has been of the Bush administration compared to, say, the Clinton administration or Bush 1, for that matter? Has the press basically had the same standard, or has there been differences?
Well, I think that...
and again, I'm talking mainstream press.
Yeah, the mainstream, mostly corporate media. I think that there's been a real tendency to let Bush slide, partly because there's a general, and I am generalizing here, corporate predisposition that sees extreme commitment to, say, privatization or militaristic policies as kind of part of the baseline that should be accepted. But there's also been acceptance of this extreme pattern of deception. So proportionally, I think that this administration has gotten along with a heck of a lot, gotten away with a heck of a lot more than, say, the Clinton administration in that regard. One example would be, and the caller was bringing up documentaries about Rumsfeld and so forth, just about a week or so ago, Donald Rumsfeld testified on Capitol Hill. And he, in response to a question from Senator Hillary Clinton, said, and I'm quoting here, he was accused of making rosy assurances about what could be done in Iraq. And this was Secretary Rumsfeld's response. He said, quote, "Senator, I don't think that's true. I've never painted a rosy picture. I've been very measured in my words. And you'd have a dickens of a time trying to find instances where I've been excessively optimistic," unquote. Well, this isn't a matter of opinion. It's a matter of fact. And that's supposed to be the bread and butter of reporters. You hear what officials say. You weigh their assertions against the past public record. The Washington Post, New York Times didn't get into it. The LA Times simply said that Rumsfeld issued a point-by-point defense, and on and on. And so we get to a realm, and this is a kind of enabling process from the news media, where facts quite literally don't matter. And yet on the record are years and years of statements under oath and otherwise from Donald Rumsfeld making, by any definition, very rosy predictions about what would happen in Iraq from the U.S. standpoint.
Our guest, Norman Solomon. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. If you'd like to call in and speak with Norman Solomon, the number 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Norman Solomon, syndicated columnist, writes the Media Beat column, also author of the new book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Let's go back to the phone lines. Now we have a full bank of calls, Norman.
Great.
Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Hi, I heard you recently say something that was quite affecting, and that was that given this attack on Lebanon, all beyond the bounds of what would have been a reasonable response to a border crossing, that these arguments that Israel is a reliable holder of nuclear weapons and that we don't have to worry about that, you know, that's why they can be the exception or something. There's a related sort of thing that constantly says that democracies don't attack democracies. Well, that seems to be wrong as well. I'm not accepting that democracy is really the goal, but I'm just trying to get at the language a little bit, I guess.
Yeah.
But I know you'll want to respond to that, but I don't know. I read Edmund Burke III's piece in the Chronicle online a while back, Middle East Spun Again, and he suggests that casus belli might be a lie, that El Shab is really where the soldiers were captured, and it was actually Hezbollah capturing Israelis on the Lebanese side. I don't know what to make of it. I haven't been able to really find out anything about it. There's an AP reporter named Panossian who says that he's one of the first originators of the report that this is where it happened. In a way, it's immaterial because the border didn't mean that much to Israel because it was always crossing it. It was flying over South Lebanon all the time. It was kidnapping people. So I don't know. Maybe it's not a good strategy to focus on questioning something at that level, but I can't help doing it, and I don't know whether you've looked at it at all or not.
Well, it's clear, and this has come out in the last couple of weeks, that Israel had a very definite plan to launch a very similar such attack as they have, going back more than a year, looking for, one might say, a reason or pretext, depending on how you look at it. It's been a truism of U.S. media coverage in the last 4 weeks that, quote, it all started, unquote, with the capture, if you will, kidnapping, whatever, of a couple of Israeli soldiers. But There is an open question which side of the border those soldiers were on, but I think more profoundly that none of this happens in a vacuum, and that it's somewhat preposterous for journalists to say it all started on X date, because there was a response there as well. You had to read the fine print of the New York Times on a back page to see that Lebanon for many weeks now has been requesting the return of Lebanese civilians who they say were kidnapped from Lebanese territory by the Israeli government. So a lot of it is the mindset and the frame within which all this is reported. I often think of what W.H. Auden wrote in his poem in 1939, "Those to whom evil is done do evil in return," and factual matters are left simply off the table routinely. For instance, to me, a very important source on the Middle East conflict involving Palestine and Israel and Lebanon is the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, and it reported just a few days ago on August 5th that last month in July, the Israeli military killed 163 Palestinians in Gaza Strip, half of whom weren't taking part in any hostilities. And then you look at Lebanon, the death ratio is about 10 to 1, 10 people in Lebanon for one in Israel. And yet to the U.S. media, those realities are at best incidental.
Now, you've covered this issue, Norman Solomon, a great deal. I've read your columns on the Middle East and Israel and Palestine. How does U.S. press coverage compare, to your knowledge, to Western Europe or to Israel itself?
Well, ironically, the coverage of the conflicts involving Israel in the U.S. press is are much more knee-jerk pro-Israel than the Israeli Hebrew language press, for that matter, the Israeli English language press. And it's a bending over backwards. I think it's multifactorial in terms of reasons, certainly as in so many world hotspot bits of coverage or areas of coverage, driven largely out of the Oval Office and the mood on Capitol Hill. And then, of course, pro-Israel sentiment, what's been called the Israel lobby, all that combines to bring enormous pressure on media outlets, and not only in the news coverage. You know, it's very difficult in the last month to find a regular, widely syndicated columnist, and I'm certainly not one of those, but who has millions of readers routinely as a syndicated columnist, to take a position that challenges fundamentally what Israel has been up to the last month. But you flip that over and you see how common it is to have a sort of vitriol standard approach towards Palestinians, certainly towards Hezbollah. And I give as one example of something where if the shoe were on the other foot, I think he probably would have lost his job now, and that is Richard Cohen at the Washington Post, nationally syndicated, who said, and I'm quoting here in a column in late July, "Anyone who knows anything about the Middle East knows that proportionality is madness." And he goes on to say that it's not enough for Israel to engage in proportionality. He says, quote, "It is necessary to reestablish deterrence. You slap me, I will punch out your lights," unquote. You decode that is, and what it means is you capture one or two of our soldiers or kill one or two of our people, we will kill 50 or 100 of you and subject your large cities to airborne terror.
Norman Solomon, the other part of the question the caller had dealt with nuclear weapons, a subject you've written about a lot with regard to Iran and really the whole global situation. I guess I didn't see this, but you made a comment about, you know, Israel's possession of nuclear weapons and view of its actions. But talk a little bit about the whole nuclear weapons issue, how it's covered in the media, and what's really missing in the discussion in the United States press.
Yeah, well, just before the invasion of Iraq, Richard Butler, the UN inspector, who certainly took a pro-U.S. position most of the time, commented that when he went to Baghdad to talk about the alleged weapons of mass destruction in the Saddam Hussein regime, he said he found it very difficult to urge against development of nuclear weapons when, as he put it, down the road in Israel there are 200 nuclear bombs. The reality is that there's one country in the Middle East which has a nuclear arsenal, and that is Israel. I think it would be preposterous, particularly after the last 5 weeks, for somebody to argue that Israel is a paragon of restraint when it comes to utilizing high-tech weaponry. They've shown that they're willing, out of the Israeli government, to do what they think is necessary, including a very blunt instrument of slaughtering a lot of people in populated areas because they feel in their top council of government and military that it's something that is necessary for the security of Israel. When I went to Tehran a year ago and I was able to be at meetings with not only students but fairly high-ranking officials and so forth, And they were very keenly aware of the hypocrisy of the U.S. government and, for that matter, the Israeli government. The fact is, to this moment, the Iranian regime has been a signer of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. They've been accused of bending those rules. They really have stayed within it. But you can't say that Israel or Pakistan or India have violated the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty because none of them have signed it in the first place. And yet they get a pass from the U.S. government, not for that reason, because they haven't signed it, but because they're aligned with the government and their geopolitical strategies. And the U.S. news media in general have internalized that double standard to the point that Israel, Pakistan, and India are portrayed as the nuclear good guys, even though they all have nuclear weapons. And a plutonium regimen has just been revealed by the Washington Post that we can be looking at dozens and dozens of nuclear warheads being churned out by the Pakistani government on an annual basis.
Our guest is Norman Solomon. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live. We have a full bank of phone callers wanting to speak with Norman Solomon. So let's go right back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Cocoa Beach, Florida. Welcome to Illinois.
Hi there, gentlemen. I really appreciate your show. I think that you spoke of net neutrality and the issue of how the Internet might become like the rest of the telecom industry. And something that's just struck me recently is to look at that vision and kind of turn it around and see network neutrality is the first battle in a long war of total telecom neutrality. You look at currently take the satellite television system that's the satellites that are up floating over us are will cost about $10 per American for the network, but somehow it's $60 a month due to a lot of this artificial scarcity that they put into the system. And I think striving towards, say, do the same thing with provide a television service and a mass media that's net neutral, advertising free, and that sort of stuff, a free market of ideas. When you look at so much of what we're talking about, the influence of sponsors on the press and these mass media networks and folks like Rupert Murdoch having this, creating this this definitely not neutral sort of news, it seems that would be that's just the vision I'd like to toss out about taking net neutrality beyond the Internet and into the rest of mass media.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Norm, have you written about net neutrality?
Well, a little bit, and learned from Free Press and other groups about the battle that's raging right now. I think that the fight for democratic discourse, as the caller, I think, indicates, has to be engaged in terms of the Internet and, for that matter, through all media. And we shouldn't cede any ground. We should fight over TV and radio. But certainly the Internet, I think people's voices, unfiltered by money, have a stronger foothold. And it remains to be seen whether the playing field is going to be corrupted and crushed by the corporate interests in league with their enablers in Washington and so forth. I'm really struck. I mean, I have to acknowledge that 5 years ago, I didn't really comprehend the extent to which the Internet would be very, very important to build alternative structures and institutions and means of communication. You know, I do think there's still a caveat we need to recall that ever since the late 1700s and perhaps before, every new technological innovation was touted as the pathway to democracy. You know, the first crude telegraph, certainly in the last 100 years, radio, broadcast TV, cable television, satellite TV, the Internet, all this, you know, with a big drum roll, that's going to make our lives democratic or more so. And I think clearly history ought to be informing us that that's not the case, that people make democracy work, that people organize, analyze their situation, and they're able to coalesce not because of technology but using technology. One thing that I think continues to be very disturbing is the corruption of public broadcasting. And I think PBS is probably the biggest example. I would just kind of close my little soapbox statement here with this comment. The most important news show on PBS is the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. It is now being underwritten by, and that's the operative euphemism, Pacific Life Insurance Company, the agribusiness giant Archer Daniels Midland, CIT Financial Services, and now added in BP Energy conglomerates. The second most important, arguably, Washington Week, formerly Washington Week in Review, two big sponsors joined this year, a total of two they have on board, Boeing Corporation and Chevron. Can one imagine any more politically sensitive industries than the aerospace and oil energy industries? You can't imagine, and yet these are the sponsors of non-commercial broadcasting, one of its most important programs. I would just close with this. The Washington Week program a few months ago signed on a partnership with National Journal, the print magazine, and the publisher of National Journal, John Fox Sullivan, explained why they were partnering with Washington Week on PBS. He said they're close to 1.8 million viewers each week, and they include, quote, people who have power and influence and exercise their power and influence, unquote.
Our guest is Norman Solomon. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live today, August 13th, 2006, from WILL AM 580 in Urbana. As I said, we have several callers waiting to talk with Norman Solomon. We'll get to them in a second. Our phone number here, 333-9455, if you wish to join them, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. One point about the internet, you're talking about how it's become an ability for people to organize and get engaged politically that you didn't anticipate 5 years ago. One of the groups that's probably most famous for this is the group MoveOn.org, which has used the internet and email to build up an army of millions. And it's one of the groups that's been credited, along with the blogosphere, with helping the Netroots develop and the Lamont campaign in Connecticut and in others. You've also been quite critical of MoveOn on a couple of occasions. A friendly criticism, but no less criticism, and at least two occasions in the last year. We'll talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I suppose it's the inverse of it. It's an ill wind that blows no good. There's some very good wind blowing from MoveOn as an organizing group. But also a downside, and I think ironically one of those downsides is that in reaction to political terrain dominated by money, it was in fact the capacity of MoveOn to raise money that first jolted it into kind of the political stratosphere back in the Iowa caucus campaign for Howard Dean, and that whole capability of groups in general aligned with MoveOn to raise millions of dollars. And so that somewhat notorious mother's milk of politics, mega cash, became the calling card, including for the Washington punditocracy, that MoveOn became important. And while, on the one hand, yes, it's decentralized amounts of money, on the other hand, it's by no stretch of the imagination a Democratic organization. There's half a dozen people who decide who they will survey in what states to what purpose. And I think we're, at this moment, looking at the cusp of kind of part of this contradictory situation where MoveOn did a poll of people in Connecticut, found that the vast majority of their members favored Ned Lamont over Joe Lieberman. And so as a result, MoveOn endorsed Ned Lamont, who had already raised several million dollars and got on the radar screen of the media and activists, raised it mostly from himself being wealthy, so it's self-financed. And then it was the principle of money attracting money that MoveOn, I think fortunately, was part of in the Lamont-Lieberman race. Well, there's another very powerful pro-war Democrat from the Senate facing a primary challenge. Her name is Hillary Clinton. She's the leading candidate, we're told, for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2008. She's being opposed, I understand, only by one person on the primary ballot, Jonathan Tessini, the former president of the National Writers Union, and full disclosure, I'm a member of that union. And MoveOn, and I just am working on a column on this, MoveOn is, to this moment, refusing to poll its membership in New York as to whether to make an endorsement in the Hillary Clinton-Jonathan Tessini race. Tessini's very anti-war. He's challenging Hillary Clinton no less on that issue and related ones, as Ned Lamont has Joe Lieberman. So there's a way in which MoveOn, while furthering democracy, is also in a kind of a kingmaker role. And where the checks and balances are here, that's very unclear.
Let's go back to our phone lines now. Line 4, Charleston, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to the issue of withdrawal from Iraq. And I want to ask what responsibility we have to fix what we broke. For example, you know, the electrical system is destroyed. And how can we fix it in light of an insurgency whose efforts are to make sure we can't do it by bombing what's already been fixed? it seems like we're damned if we do, and we're damned if we don't. Like, if we just pull out, we're going to be seen as just, you know, destroying a country and leaving. And if and we don't seem to be able to fix things, partially probably because of what the administration's goals are and the presence of people like Bechtel or whatever that company's called, the Cheney's associated with.
Halliburton.
Halliburton. And the fact that there is an insurgency there.
Well, I think that's a pretty meaty question there, Charles, and let's let Norman answer it.
Yeah, I think it's an important one, and I wish there was generally more mainstream U.S. media debate on those really troubling questions that I think we do have. We can say that we have a responsibility to fix what we broke, but if we continue to say that we have a right to keep, quote-unquote, fixing what we broke, then it seems to be an incentive for people in power to get over the hump of launching a war with the argument that then the war has been launched, so they have carte blanche to try to clean up the mess. And I think that's historically been true, certainly the last several decades, with the Vietnam War, what went on in Southeast Asia. And now we're hearing that argument as well on behalf of Israel in terms of Lebanon, that they can't just leave either. The notion that countries have a right because they have the might to invade another country, bomb, and then stay, I think is a prescription for international chaos as well as vast slaughter, you know, which is what we're seeing. So I would agree with those, and I believe it was Daniel Ellsberg who I heard say this. He said, the alternative of the U.S. quickly withdrawing all of its forces from Iraq is a very bad alternative, and all the other ones are worse.
Let's go back to our phone lines if we can. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Thank you. A couple of things. First, with respect to your earlier comments about Rumsfeld and Rosie scenarios, other than Democracy Now!, which I'm not sure you can really count as a mainstream media outlet, the only place I saw any rejoinder to that was actually Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, where after a little derision over the word Dickens, he showed series of three quotes back to back of rosy scenarios on the part of Rumsfeld.
And yeah, well, quite a contrast to Chris Wallace on Fox News, who reported, quote, Rumsfeld gave as good as he got. So I suppose that Stewart is the anti-Fox there.
Yeah. And also with respect to the issue of impeachment, which, you know, I don't see much realistic possibility of here. I think if we really did have a democratic media that was exposing, you know, what they've been doing, that the question would not merely be whether or not to impeach Bush, Cheney at all, but whether or not we should be turning them over to The Hague for war crimes.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because occasionally when I speak at a public forum, someone will say, and I think, you know, with a lot of good thinking behind the comment, that we need to give credit to our mainstream media for having wide-ranging debate on op-ed pages and elsewhere. And I think that over, and there's a point there, but often my response is, okay, go to the NexusLexis database, which is pretty comprehensive in the U.S. news media, and try to find or see how many instances you can find of an op-ed page article in a major newspaper or a commentary on National Public Radio where the case is made for putting George W. Bush on trial for war crimes. And when you total up all those numbers of instances where those arguments are allowed to be made in the mainstream news media, you will have an index of the extent to which we have really, really wide-ranging discourse. Reality is that it's not an absurd contention at all. When you look at what Robert Jackson, the U.S. Supreme Court Justice, said when he was a delegate in August of 1945 at what became the Nuremberg Tribunals, he said that the supreme international crime is to prepare and carry out aggressive war. And certainly a strong case could be made that the Bush administration did just that in terms of Iraq.
Our guest is Norman Solomon. Thank you so much, caller, for calling. Norman, you wrote a column recently along these lines. I think it was called Our Barbarism, or Their Barbarism and Ours, which touched on the U.S. torture and U.S. Illegal activities and war crimes. in Iraq, also in Afghanistan, Guantanamo in recent years. You talked about op-eds right now. What has been the nature of press coverage of war crimes by the United States, of torture, compared to torture done against the United States?
Well, I think while there was certainly a strong reaction against Abu Ghraib, and there's been some real criticism of the treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo, the most important vehicles for criticism of policy are the front pages and the repeated coverage in the range of media outlets. And there, the barbarism of the foe in Iraq and al-Qaeda and so forth gets a lot more emphasis that is repeated. And, you know, we're certainly in the throes of the latest round here now. And certainly the terrorism engaged in, if we're going to call it that, by al-Qaeda and by those who are blowing up civilians in Iraq, you know, that has been condemned, should be condemned. But I think it's crucial for journalists and really for citizens to have a single standard of human rights and a single standard of terrorism. And as Thomas Merton, the great theologian, said, "When do you think you're better because you burn your enemies from high in the air?" And we have a bias not only of a political nature, but the notion that if from 10,000 feet cluster bombs or phosphorus weapons or 2,000-pound bombs are dropped, that somehow that makes us morally on the high ground. I don't think that can stand a lot of scrutiny.
Our guest is Norman Solomon. You're listening to Media Matters. We have a couple phone lines open if you'd like to talk with Norman Solomon. Norman, of course, is a syndicated columnist who writes the Media Beat column and the author of the new book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, just came out last year. Number here, 333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Urbana, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
Thank you, and thank you for this wonderful program. I wondered if your guest might comment on any contrast between the editorial board of the Washington Post and the New York Times. It seems like the Washington Post editorial board has just become like off the deep end, super warmonger hawks. It seemed like early on in the Lebanon War, the most recent Lebanon War, the New York Times started editorializing pretty firmly for an immediate ceasefire, whereas the Washington Post was saying, basically, the war must go on. So I wondered if you had any comment on that, like how that came about, and is that a permanent fixture of the landscape?
Well, it's always compared to what? And certainly there's been a trend in the last 40 years. The Washington Post has moved to the right. If you look back at a reported meeting between the liberal Joe Rao and Donald Graham, who's, you know, inherited the paper, basically. There's the story where he says, "Joe, you don't understand. This isn't the Washington Post that it used to be." I think that's true, not to glorify it in the past. And let me just regress to say that I read the Washington Post during the Vietnam War, and I've gone back and looked at it, and they were very pro-war. So there's nothing to, in terms of Vietnam, so there's nothing to hearken back to as being great from a progressive standpoint, but they've certainly moved to a more hawkish position in the last 20 years. They had an editorial of the Post on August 8th of this year, and I'm quoting here, they said, "What does matter is that the Israelis not be forced to withdraw until a serious new force arrives." And it's a very, as the caller I think you're alluding to, a very hawkish pro-Israel position. But if you go back, and I talk about this in the Warm and Easy book with a lot of citations, to the supposed opposition by the New York Times before the invasion of Iraq, true, it was not gung-ho for war the way that the Washington Post was, but the New York Times, the morning after Colin Powell's now infamous presentation to the UN Security Council on February 5th, 2002, the New York Times was giving a lot of ground and saying, "Well, you know, he made a convincing case, and we may need to go there."
Was that 2002 or 2003?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, 2003.
Okay, Norm. Another big story that's happened recently, and I do want to talk about it before we go off the air, has been the failing health of Fidel Castro in Cuba and the future of Cuba following Castro. And the media has given it quite a bit of attention, covering some of the celebrations and some of the government planning in the United States. What is missing from the mainstream press coverage in the United States of the story of what life is like in Cuba and what's going on with Cuban politics?
Well, I think it's painted, you know, with very few shades of gray. And the question of, you know, what has been the life expectancy in Cuba under the Castro regime, what has been the health care and the literacy rate, and all these achievements which are superlative in the Latin American context have been, you know, rarely referred to. And I say that as somebody who is, you know, very much against the idea that state power is turned over from somebody to his brother, or for that matter, considered to be a prerogative for life. You know, I don't believe in that, and I think that a democratization process needs to take place. On the other hand, I hear, for instance, on NPR, I heard a report where somebody who was a refugee from Cuba after several decades said, you know, it was actually a commentary I heard on NPR, where somebody was saying, yes, I can't wait for democracy to return to Cuba. And I thought, you know, where's the history here? The guerrillas that Castro led overthrew a corrupt and torturing regime of Batista. And so, you know, history and the question of how do we compare the repression in Cuba compared to the repression that the U.S. bankrolled and supported in Latin America for so many years, and in some senses, some places is still pushing towards. It's just a lack of context that I think we suffer from in terms of news media here.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's see what we have here. Line 4, Farina again. Welcome back.
Hi, thank you very much, and thank you for giving us all hope here. I'd like to first comment that whatever misdemeanors occurred in previous administrations are really irrelevant, except for the fact that many of the major players are still in positions like Rumsfeld and Cheney. But what we see happening today is so much more than just misdemeanors, because they're actually hijacking our democratic way of life, and this is a historical emergency on a level never seen before. And it's also an attempt, they're also attempting to establish these obscene practices like torture and so on as the new way of American life. And so the question I ask is, how can the public, first of all, demand that facts be stated as fact, not opinion, and also demand that the context be given so that we can get the spin out of the misappropriation of information?
Thank you, caller. Norman?
Well, I think it's a challenge that is not only, quote-unquote, a media challenge, but it's a broad political one, and we can't really separate realities of political power and the dysfunction of institutions politically or the function of them with closely held autocratic power from just the broader ways that so many of our institutions have been affected by privatization, by the expectations being dropped, even. Although I don't, you know, it might seem far afield from your main points, but the fact that working people now are being acculturated and propagandized not to expect a pension that they can depend on. Well, that's a huge change from a few decades ago. It's part of a privatization of our work life, of our social sphere, and of what we can expect from our government. It's no coincidence that so much of the military and occupation activities in Iraq from the U.S. government have been privatized as well. So I certainly wouldn't disagree with the points that you're making. This is an emergency. It's not atypical, though, of the type of crises that we faced, even if it is now more extreme.
Norman, what media do you use in addition to reading the New York Times and the mainstream press? What other media do you use to sort of get a corrective or to get alternative views or to help you develop your critique of the mainstream media?
Well, I do try to contrast and compare, so reading and looking at mainstream U.S. corporate media a lot, but also looking at British outlets like The Independent and The Guardian, going to websites including Media Channel, FAIR, the Media Watch Group's site, Alternet, Common Dreams, Truthout. Not that there's gospel to be found there, but often the information and the analysis provide real correctives to the sort of the knee-jerk circumscribed coverage that we can depend on from the mainstream press.
Our guest is Norman Solomon. You're listening to Media Matters. We've only got about 3 or 4 minutes left, and we've got two callers patiently waiting. Let's try to get to both of them right now. Line 1, Chicago, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, sir. My question, how realistic is turning Bush and Cheney to The Hague? Second, what role did the Bush Wars played in making Hezbollah the military power they are now? To add, I was a United Nations doctor in Lebanon during the late 80s. By deposing Saddam Hussein, he was the equalizer, and his militia men in Lebanon kept a cab on all other religious militias not to develop in the military power they are now creating, the havoc they are creating.
Well, one thing you're reminding me of is that that Hamas was created quite consciously by the Israeli government because they wanted to undermine the PLO. And in a different way, I suppose you could say Hezbollah has been created by the Israelis through the occupation, the horrible invasion and then of Lebanon up to Beirut and then the occupation of South Lebanon. So really, as is so often the case, the occupation of people's lands creates resistance. And as Menachem Begin, who by many descriptions was a terrorist, is a case in point, it's not pretty. It's sometimes very, very deadly. I certainly don't think it's realistic to expect Bush and Cheney to go to The Hague, but these issues need to be raised.
Let's go back to the phone lines for our final caller of the show today. Line 2 on a cell phone, you're on the air with Norman Solomon.
It's just a bit of gossip. I was wondering if either of you saw Galloway. I'm not even sure what program it was because I saw it on YouTube talking about the Middle East in like a BBC interview or something.
I think it's actually a Sky TV interview. That's the Murdoch channel.
Oh, okay. I had never seen anything like that. Someone who basically rephrased all of the journalist questions in a very forceful way. Is this ever done, or is that the first time this has ever been done on TV? That's all.
Well, I've heard about that interview, but more generically, and I can't remember who said it, but there's a lot to it, that good answers destroy the question. And especially given the quality of the questions that come from most of our corporate-funded media in this country, that's a good step.
Norman Solomon, we've got about a minute, minute and a half left on Media Matters today. Going forward in the 2006 off-year elections coming up with the war in Iraq, with the Lamont victory over Lieberman, what do you anticipate or what are you looking for in the next few months in the U.S. political electoral scene?
Well, I think there's, you know, clearly a lot at stake, and I believe it's very important what happens with majority control of the House and Senate. Everything in the track record of Karl Rove, and there's a great book by a couple of journalists called Bush's Brain about Rove's history, should make us believe that a lot of stops will be pulled out, and that whatever the polling numbers and focus groups say should be accentuated on terrorism and other issues will become fodder from the Republican campaign. And unfortunately, the mainstream media can't be depended upon to deconstruct or analyze it very incisively. And that really falls to all of us to make this more democratic as a process for political decisions.
You know, there's been a lot of talk about the 2004 election having been stolen. I had you on the air immediately after the election, and I think you were somewhat cynical or skeptical of those claims. Have you changed your opinion with the new revelations and new research that's been done?
Yeah, I think there's a lot more to it than I certainly thought a few days after the election. And the research people are doing is really disturbing and underscores just how important these democratic processes are, or we're going to lose them.
Our guest today has been Norman Solomon. Norman, I want to thank you so much for being on the air.
Hey, thank you, Bob.
I hear the band tuning up in the background. That means Tavis Smiley wants to get into the studio. My name's Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Our producer, Andrew Boyle, my technical director, Brett Polson. 1 week from today, we'll have John Bellamy Foster as our guest. I'll see you then. Thank you very much for joining us.